state budget surplus, a moratorium on federal civics and history grants, and a potential challenger for Governor Noem. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, August 4th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome political scientists John Schaff and Mike Card. We'll dig into how COVID money is changing the debate over state spending. We explore the future of electric cars as it intersects with South Dakota research. We remember Glenna Fulberg as we touch base with the class of 2020 inductees into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. Plus, Moment in Sound with Eliza Blue. We welcome the singer-songwriter to the studio for live music. That's later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. Pennington County authorities say a months-long investigation has turned up large quantities of drugs, including 72 pounds of methamphetamine worth as much as $2.5 million. Sergeant Casey Kenrick of the Unified Narcotics Task Force calls it a big win for Pennington County and says it's important to hold dealers responsible for their violence and addiction they perpetuate in our community. Four new members of the Rapid City Area School Board were sworn in at a recent meeting. The full-to-capacity room got chaotic during the public comment section. SDPB's Richard Tubles reports.
Dr. Valeria Big Eagle is the president of the Title VI Indian Educational Parental Advisory Commission with Rapid City Area Schools. Earlier this year, the district formed an Indigenous Education Task Force to improve the educational experience, learning environment, and outcomes for Indigenous students. Big Eagle says she attended the school board meeting with Lakota Elder Dr. Art Zimiga. They attended to voice concern with the new board members about the district's plans for Native American-based education.
There were two open seats, and I was trying to sit myself and, well, Dr. Zimiga, mainly because he's an elder, and sit down. And we were, no, they were saving those seats for someone else that was not there. And that lady just yelled in my face, like, I do not care. But you can tell what racism looks like. You know, we feel it. And that's what it was.
Zimiga found a seat and Big Eagle moved to an overflow room to watch the proceedings on Zoom.
Oh my goodness. You could just feel the hate in there. They were booing people that were talking. They just do not understand it. And so whenever I talked on Monday night, I attributed my success to my culture.
According to Big Eagle, the district's plans are still going forward with the Lakota Immersion curriculum at Canyon Lake Elementary this upcoming school year. The next Rapid City School Board of Education meeting is on August 9th. I'm SDPB's Richard Tubles in Rapid City.
A top health official says the Sturgis motorcycle rally could spread the COVID-19 Delta variant. Dr. Shankar Kura is vice president of the medical affairs at Monument Health in Rapid City. He says an outbreak traced to Provincetown, Massachusetts over the 4th of July weekend caused nearly 1,000 cases.
We will see a rise in numbers after the rally and probably within 10 days, just like in Provincetown. 10 days from the first event, they had a surge of cases. We will see that. The question then remains, how many of those folks' cases we see are vaccinated cases? Because the ones that are not vaccinated will end up in the hospital requiring ICU care and unfortunately may even succumb to the disease.
Vaccinated people can still contract the Delta variant, but Kura says vaccines offer important protections.
If you've got the vaccine, it doesn't matter if you got the Johnson & Johnson or either of the two mRNA vaccines, the Moderna or the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, you are protected in one important sense. You will not suffer the consequences of severe disease and death.
The Sturgis Motorcycle Rally begins on Friday. Augustana University is expanding its reach to Central America. The Sioux Falls School is planning a study abroad program with a campus in Costa Rica. The program will be one semester long. Augustana is looking for a location for classes, housing, transportation, and other arrangements. The Costa Rica campus is set to open in 2023. With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson.
I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota's registered nurses stood on the front lines and at the bedside during the darkest days of the COVID pandemic. The transition from student nurse to professional nurse is not an easy one, even in non-pandemic times. Sanford Health's nursing residency program provides support to new graduate nurses. The program was recently awarded full accreditation with distinction from the American Nurses Credentialing Center. Erica DeBoer is Chief Nursing Officer at Sanford Health. I spoke with her about efforts to secure what she calls the brilliance at the bedside.
As a new nurse entering in the walls of our clinics as well as our hospitals, you're really developing your profession. You're learning and putting into practice all those skills that you learned as part of your clinicals and part of all that learning that you did during your 2 and 4 year degree. So the nurse residency program isn't just about developing the skills and orienting you to the spaces where you're going to be working. It's also a really valuable part to develop professional relationships, learn new ways to enhance those clinical outcomes, as well as strengthen leadership abilities in their position as a nurse at Sanford.
All right. So when you talk about clinical outcomes, you're talking about us, the patients, the people who are going to go into Sanford and interact with these nurses. How does it help the patient? And will they know, will they see the difference in a hospital setting, for example, that this program exists?
I absolutely believe that they will. The nursing residency program is powered not only by the preceptors at the bedside that are helping with those clinical skills, but we have phenomenal facilitators and mentors that really help our new nurses as they onboard, not just into that clinical setting, but helps them develop add their leadership skills as well as all those care standards and the evidence to deliver that quality outcomes to our patient. The program really truly does provide strategies that strengthen well-being, resiliency, while also enhancing their clinical judgment and leadership capacity. The program focuses on a multitude of different areas, as I mentioned, professional role as a nurse, as well as those quality outcomes, because we know that it's the brilliance at the bedside that help deliver that amazing care to our patients every day.
All right, here we go, because we know how difficult it has been to be in nursing during the pandemic. Was this program in process before the pandemic? How did the pandemic influence the rollout and the application for this accreditation?
I'm so happy that you asked that question. I'm extremely proud of the teams that pulled the residency program together. They actually did it amidst the COVID pandemic, and it actually became even more important for us to deliver this residency program, knowing that in uncertain times in the beginning of COVID, we couldn't have our student nurses in to do their clinical experiences. So as we look at really the benefit that this offers is all of our new graduate registered nurses with less than 12 months of experience are enrolled automatically into the nurse residency program when they begin their employment with Sanford Health. And so it does make a huge difference in building that community and helping those new nurses coming into our walls to understand the important culture and care that we provide to our patients every day.
What do you hope is the impact on recruitment for quality nurses, and where are those recruits coming from? Mostly from South Dakota, from the region. So what do you hope, and where are these people coming from?
Oh, great question. We have a lot of amazing colleges of nursing within our footprint, across the Sanford footprint. And so we have nurses coming in not only from our state schools, but we also have several private schools that actually help support really our recruitment and our pipeline into our system. So my hope is that this program offers really a differentiated experience to our new nurses that are joining our team. We have accreditation, as I mentioned, that applies to 22 workplace settings across 9 sites. So our program is available throughout our enterprise, and really we're working on developing not only our amazing nursing practice, but really dividing and conquering and making sure that those nurses that are joining our Sanford team are well prepared and become resilient, highly clinically professional, as well as be leaders really for the future and really build our nursing workforce of the future.
So how long have you been in nursing? And did you have anything like this when you came up in the field? Do you wish you had something like this?
I've actually been part of the Sanford family for 26 years. I actually started as a nursing assistant in one of our Good Sam locations in Jackson, Minnesota. And since then, went to school, joined the team at Sanford on the pulmonary unit, and have been a part of the Sanford team ever since in a multitude of different roles. I actually was extremely blessed to be part of a residency program through my College of Nursing. But really since then, the residency program is based out of Sanford in partnership with the American Nurses Credentialing Center. And it is a program that's a bit different than what I experienced. And absolutely, the residency program is going to be a differentiator and a game changer for our new teams that are joining. It also offers great opportunities to our preceptors, our mentors, and our facilitators at each one of those systems to help them grow and become additional leaders and professionals in that role, too, because they're continuing to develop themselves as they help to develop others.
That's Erica DeBoer, Chief Nursing Officer at Sanford Health. I spoke with her yesterday. Ahead on the program, electric cars and the future of South Dakota transportation. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. The Biden administration announces new sanctions against Cuba after protests in Washington, Miami, and Havana last month.
I want the Cuban Americans to know we all around this table, and myself included, see your pain. We hear your voices, and we hear the cries of freedom coming from the island.
We'll have the latest next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
On the next Fresh Air, understanding Osama bin Laden. As the 20th anniversary of 9/11 approaches, we speak with Peter Bergen, one of the world's foremost authorities on Al-Qaeda. He has a new biography of bin Laden. Bergen says he wanted to understand why bin Laden created an organization dedicated to mass murder. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Mitco Business. We're in the business of helping partners go up and to the right. Head in the right direction with customized business internet, phone, and TV solutions to stay in touch and in control. More at midco.com/business.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walz. From a bursting budget surplus to an executive order that pauses federal grant applications for history and civics, the Dakota Political Junkies have plenty to talk about this week. Let's get things started by welcoming this week's panelists. Mike Card is an associate professor of political science at the University of South Dakota, and he joins us from SDPB's Vermilion Studios at USD. Hey, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, John Schaff, professor of political science at Northern State University in Aberdeen, and he is joining us from SDPB's Tom and Danielle Ahman Foundation Studio at NSU. John, welcome back. We're going to start with you, Mike Card. And I want to start with this federal grant applications for history and civics. So Governor Kristi Noem issued an executive order that said, hey, we need to put a pause on applying for all federal history and civics grants until the legislative session meets. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of why she's doing that, what's the impact of that for someone like you at the University of South Dakota, for professors in higher education?
Well, you know, first of all, I think the issue is one that she directed the Department of Education not to apply for any grants. Mm-hmm. And they have a $900,000 appropriation from the legislature to work on these sorts of issues. So in many senses, it doesn't make much sense. It's done to perhaps illustrate a point that we need to wait and we need to think about what the legislature is going to do regarding civics education in South Dakota. More perhaps concerning to someone like me who runs field projects for students, you know, one of the projects that I run is in the state and local government class. I have them analyze criteria for a healthy community, and they choose their hometown and identify the issues that have made towns in general of their size successful, and they evaluate their town and then go through the policy process. Given what we've identified or they've identified as deficiencies, who in the community might help them get this going? And it seems as though from the wording of the executive order, I shouldn't do that because civics education and active civics project are suggested not to belong. So I think the legislature has some work to do in order to find what they're actually not wanting us to teach the youth of the state and perhaps the teachers of the state. Because right now it's a little broad, because I really don't think they want me to stop projects like that to identify and make South Dakota small towns more healthy and more sustainable economically, socially, and as well as environmentally.
Yeah. So it says when we look at the text of the executive order, during the 2022 legislative session, it's anticipated that the legislative branch and executive branch will cooperate on legislation that will, at a minimum, prohibit any curriculum that requires or encourages students to take positions against one another on the basis of race, sex, or the historical activity of members of a student's race or sex, and prevent schools from politicizing education by prohibiting any curriculum that requires students to protest or lobby during or after school. What's going on here with the curriculum that requires students to protest and lobby?
Well, students have free speech rights. And even this past Supreme Court session, the court perhaps expanded those free speech rights to include activities where it wasn't during school time, it wasn't during school facilities, but might have involved school decisions. And a young woman made a small TikTok movie that she pulled down. And in the course of that, the school suspended her from her junior varsity cheerleading program, as well as, and then she quit after she made this video. But the Supreme Court said that was an unconstitutional limitation on free speech, because we do have free speech rights, at least protected from government intervention, and a school district is a government entity. And since it's a fundamental right, strict standards are applied as to prohibiting someone from losing fundamental rights.
Mm-hmm. We're going to bring John Schaaf from Northern State University into the conversation now. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm all right.
We're starting our segment with this look at the governor's executive order 2021-11. And we've been talking a little bit about the impact of, you know, refraining from applying for federal grants while we wait for legislators in the 2022 session. But let's dive into some of the other, nuts and bolts of this executive order. This is the first time I have personal memory of a governor of South Dakota calling out a person, a scholar by name, and she mentions the work of Ibram X. Kendi. She mentions the 1619 Project. Those are two separate things. She says they are, quote, infused with factual errors. Have you seen this before, John, where someone says, you know, a governor of a state says this scholar, not him?
I'm sure it has happened, but I'm unaware of it. If it has, it's certainly, I think we can say at a minimum, it's unusual, to say the least. And obviously the governor is responding to controversial views that certain scholars like Ibram Kendi or the 1619 Project wish to further. And I was in the original draft of the federal orders on these things, Kendi himself. And so the introduction of Ibram Kendi in 1619 didn't come from Christy Noem. It came from the federal government. And so the governor is responding to something that was there, which was eventually taken out of the federal regulations. But what's originally there, and as I think is indicated in the executive order and public statements by the governor subsequent, the ethos of those teachings are still there. And the ethos, there's at least enough there, I think, for the governor to be concerned. And so when you have a theory of critical race theory, which teaches, and I quote from two critical race theorists, Richard Delgado and Gene Stefanik, quote, unlike traditional civil rights, critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law. So do we really want a theory taught in our schools which questions the liberal order, that questions the very idea of equality before the law, that questions even rational thinking or neutral principles of law? And that's controversial. And the teachings of Ibram Kendi, whose teachings have been described by Andrew Sullivan, for example, no nut job Andrew Sullivan, a very moderate writer, has described Kendi's teachings as totalitarian. And do we want those kinds of teachings in our K through 12 school? And I think the governor's at least on the right tack for being concerned about those. Whether that needs to then lead to an executive order stopping entities from applying for federal grants, I don't know. Then the question is always, what is the response to that? And people obviously will disagree about that.
And who gets to decide? And can you, what are the Ibram X. Kendi has written, a lot. So it, mm-hmm. you can't, he's 38 years old. Critical race theory was around long before he was. But when you look at his work and, Stamped from the Beginning, his books or How to Be Anti-Racist, he's really talking about looking at policy outcomes instead of intentions. That's one of the core, frameworks of his work. If you say you can't teach that, this is the sort of hair I'm trying to split here. And, Mike Carr, jump in here if you have an idea. Like when you say don't teach 1619, don't teach Ibram X. Kendi, what are the implications of that, and does the government get to decide that no teacher, no educator in the state of South Dakota can reference those works as part of, a lesson plan, for example, even if it's talking about it and debunking it or talking about it and asking students to think critically about it? It seems just incredibly broad and yet specific at the same time. Mike Card, help me figure that out, please.
Well, it does seem that part of our job is to help students learn to think critically and to examine multiple sides of issues and perspectives. To separate this out is, I guess it's in South Dakota, it's under the educational standards to say, which are mostly permissive, this is what a student must learn. At least as I remember it from 35 years ago, the standards specify what students are to learn to be progressing through grades. And I don't recall anything that says they can't learn this. Mm. It does remind me of my days as an undergraduate when Monsignor Doyle told us all not to go see a movie. And guess how many of us went to see the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had students this summer who don't live in South Dakota in a class ask me about this, and can I provide them any sources? Well,
sure.
if we were to prohibit this, it would seem to be that the answer is no.
Yeah, it's a huge cultural implication, John Schaff, because 1619 won a Pulitzer Prize. Stamped from the Beginning won the National Book Award. Anti-Racist, How to Be Anti-Racist is a podcast and a New York Times mm-hmm. bestselling book internationally. All of these things are repackaged as young adult literature as well. So written, and then they're written for younger people to read. How is it not just banning books?
Well, it's not banning books. Everybody understands that you cannot teach everything in school. So by definition, some things are in, some things are out. And everybody understands there are some things we don't want taught in schools. So if I was a K through 12 civics teacher and I wanted to teach Mein Kampf as true, you would object to that and say, don't teach that book as if it is true. And that would be, I guess, banning the book, but we'd all say, that's okay. If there's a movement across the country to teach white supremacy, and there are people putting money and it's going into grants, and there's federal policy saying you have to teach white supremacy or white supremacy is good, we would all say, way to go, Governor Noem, stopping South Dakota from teaching white supremacy. So everybody agrees that there is a principle, that there are some things that are so objectionable that they should not be taught in schools, that K through 12 students should not be exposed to them. The question is, what are those things? And so in that sense, we're always, quote unquote, banning something because there are some things that we find so objectionable that we don't have them taught in our schools.
Are you saying
is critical
how to be,
anti-racist
is one of the, is it one of those things to you?
I think there's at least enough there.
It's like Mein Kampf?
Well, again,
because that's a big comparison. How to be anti-racist.
Ibram Kendi says that we should create a federal organization, a federal bureau, which reviews every single policy from the federal government down to your local government to see whether there's disparate impact on race. And if it does, this federal bureau has the ability to nullify any law that it wants. He even says that we need to police the speech of people, whether it's racist or anti-racist. And remember, he says that there is no such thing as neutrality. Kendi rejects the idea of a colorblind society. And so even advocating for
a
colorblind,
the idea of a post-racial, of a post-racial society.
The way he defines it is that you are either actively working against racism, as he defines it, which actually he has difficulty defining it, or you're a racist. And
he
so,
says,
for
policy,
example,
yeah,
saying treating people as
is...
individuals, regardless of their race, should be the government policy, is to Ibram Kendi a racist policy, and there should be a government bureau to stop me, a government employee, from advocating such things.
We are going to run out of time, John Schaff. Yep. I really wanted to move on to the budget.
Yes.
And I will tell listeners, Ibram X. Kendi is going to be on the program tomorrow to answer questions about his research and the way it is interpreted and to respond to Governor Noem's executive order. So we will dive more into his research and what it says and what it doesn't say tomorrow. But I do want to get to this idea of a budget surplus, largely because of, you know, the economic strength of South Dakota during this time and during the COVID-19 pandemic, slightly different than other states, huge budget surplus because of federal funding and some different decisions about what is to be done about it. Mike Carr, do you want to weigh in on that in just a minute, please?
Well, I would. I think the first thing to do is to set the stage for your listeners to indicate that South Dakota has a couple of different reserve funds. We often refer to them as rainy day funds. You know, most financial advisors would advise every individual to have a rainy day fund, and it's good policy for a governmental organization to have a rainy day fund. At the end of the legislative session, the Bureau of Finance and Management projected, a 12% of last year's General Appropriations Act general funds, that is the funds devoted for the operation and maintenance of state government and its institutions. So there's a maximum cap of 25%, which is quite a bit. You know, if we were to take 25% of our individual homeowner budgets or our household budgets and keep it in reserve solely for the purpose of waiting for a rainy day so that because we might need it, that's an interesting question to ask. Mm. They started at 12%. Now with the addition of, I believe it was about $85, $86 million put into those rainy day funds, they're now at 16%. There happens to be 75% of the state's budget exists in trust funds and, or at least 75% of the general funds exist in trust funds sufficient that we could, again, have a sales tax holiday. That's not a good policy, is to spend down your reserves in that sense, money that you're saving for the future. And it's not good policy to review all of the tax exemptions that are also equal to about 75% of the state's general fund budget. Yeah. So that's the background at which we're looking at. We have no better use for this money than to put it away. On the other hand, the view is we may need to save this for a rainy day because the Bureau of Finance and Management in July projected a decrease of about $16 million. I might be wrong on that figure, from this year's collections. So we'll have to use some of that $85 million to make up if the projections turn out to be true.
I was going
That's
back.
The context.
Yeah,
for this.
Some context. And we're going to run out of time to talk about this, but I was going through, interestingly enough, Governor Kristi Noem's State of the State and State of the Budget address from last year, and her kind of laying out her fiscal map and saying, you know, this money is going to go away. It's not an endless fund that will keep coming from the federal government. She had concerns about what would happen to the state under the Biden administration. She was kind of laying that out very early, so she's sticking to this policy. So that is a lot of context. Without getting much further, we'll keep that conversation going. In the days ahead, we are going to have to, alas, leave it here. Mike Card is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. Dr. Card, thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
John Schaff, Professor of Political Science at Northern State University, Aberdeen. Dr. Schaff, thanks as well.
Thanks for having me, too.
Ahead on the program, we talk research and electric cars at Dakota State University. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
As COVID cases spike, some businesses want customers to show proof of vaccination.
We still ask people who weren't vaccinated to wear masks, but there's no way to know who is and who is not vaccinated.
Some people are pushing back.
Why should we have to share that information when you can't ask someone what their disability is?
How that conflict is unfolding in Michigan this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda in Rapid City. Inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda. See you at Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda, Rapid City.
Ports are backed up and trucks can only carry so much of the stuff that we import. What, then, to do?
If we don't have enough goods shipped by rail, if the congestion continues, the prices will be higher.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Traffic jams everywhere in this economy. We will have that story for you, the numbers from Wall Street as well, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie. Sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. If you're looking to save the planet, reconsidering your morning commute might be a good place to start. Vehicle transportation is the leading cause of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. While we need transportation, especially in a rural state like South Dakota, can electric vehicles help keep us on the road? A Dakota State University professor is determined to be part of the solution. Bhaskar Rimal is assistant professor of computer and cyber sciences at Dakota State University in Madison. Professor Rimal has received a competitive research grant from the South Dakota Board of Regents. The intent is to study new technology related to electric vehicles. And he joins us now on the phone. Professor Rimal, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the problem that we're facing with bringing electric cars on board, the problem that you're interested in as a research scientist.
Actually, I was thinking of, you know, how smart grid communication and vehicular network can interplay on a unified network communication platform and impact each other to reduce carbon dioxide oxide emissions. Meanwhile, I have noticed that the transportation sector is one of the major sources of CO2 emissions due to the combustion of petroleum-based products and the primary driver of energy consumption. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the transportation sector has nearly 27% of total U.S. gas emission, you know, greenhouse gas emission in 2015. And furthermore, as of 2019 data, vehicular transportation is the leading cause of greenhouse gas emission in the U.S. and producing more than 1,800 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. That's a huge amount of carbon dioxide emissions.
I'm going to jump in here and just ask you, as we talk about this unified network communications platform, you said, and this impact to reducing carbon dioxide emissions, this is multidisciplinary. It's integrative. It is all kinds of things with lots of challenges, including security, cloud storage. What problem will you deal with this project?
Especially, we have two types of problems. One problem is when we have electric vehicle on the road, we'll have surcharge load on the power grid. So how to balance that load, especially if, you know, billions of people want to, you know, charge electric vehicle at the same time, then electric power will gonna be failed. So how we can, you know, solve that charging issue? And at the same time, we have a communication issue. How to communicate those billions of electric vehicles in real time that we need, you know, a kind of unified communication infrastructure that has, you know, a lot of stories, and at the same time, we can get the real-time information within very short delay.
Yeah. So it has to be to scale in a lot of ways. Tell me what you hope the impact of this project could be.
The overall impact of this project, I can consider in two labels. One label is technological side. We'll be able to establish, you know, smart grid-enabled intelligent transportation system. And on the other hand, it has social benefits. Like, you know, as a user, you know, they could have a secure transportation system. The system will guide you, you know, where is the obstacle, where is the third spot for charging, and where are the charging station, and what is the cost at that moment. And it will be a very, you know, kind of assistive system for ordinary people. And research-wise, as you mentioned earlier, it is a multidisciplinary project, and it has three components. So we have power component, we have computing, and communications. So having all those skills is very difficult within a single person. So we are trying to develop, you know, skilled manpower on those sectors so that, you know, we'll have those students and researchers working on that unified multidisciplinary research area. Especially, we need those kind of skilled manpower.
I want to jump in here and let listeners know we've been talking with Dr. Bhaskar Rimal from Dakota State University. He's been awarded a competitive research grant from the Board of Regents. He's really looking at this cloud-based electronic vehicle, electric vehicle system that's going to, in theory, help local utility companies, help transportation users, help the South Dakota Department of Transportation and the Department of Energy, ensure safety of the power grid, and so much more, with hopes to expanding this with a bigger scale research project in the future. Dr. Rimal, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate hearing about your research.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Let's take a moment now to honor inductees into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. The enshrinement ceremony for the class of 2020 is September 11th and 12th. Glenna Foberg was known for her influence in alternative education for students who struggle in school. For 38 years, she taught in Alaska and South Dakota. The final 13 years of her career were spent as the director of the Alternative Learning Center in Aberdeen. Glenna Foberg passed away January 5th, 2021. We spoke with her on In the Moment on August 19th of last year.
And we always use the phrase, they don't care what you know, but they want to know that you care. Well, I guess when I went up to the alternative program, which was in 1990, I believe, I had been at Holgate as an English teacher for 17 years. Well, I went up to the alternative program, had a fantastic staff. There was four of us that worked with the high school kids, which at that time was 10, 11, 12. So yeah. Sometimes it was frustrating. But the staff was very persistent. When we added the junior high program, had two fantastic people, actually three. One left to go somewhere else, and then the third one came. Worked. I don't know that any of that staff member ever, if anybody missed a day of sick leave, I don't remember it. So just in getting there was a lot of persistence. But they had the best interest of the kids in their heart. Of course, there were some that, you know, almost didn't want to graduate. They'd rather fail. But I think the one philosophy that I've always used in the 30 years of teaching English, and then especially the 13 years I directed the alternative program, first of all, you have to deal with kids with humor. And the second is, I think they generally live up to expectations. And those, I wish I'd have written a book, because I think I might have think I've had a bestseller. Because I think humor, having a sense of humor, is a big part of teaching. Now, it doesn't mean you have to laugh in class every single day, but sometimes there's some humor to it that can lighten the whole situation. And every once in a while, I'll run into someone that'll say, boy, am I glad you helped me get through school. And I'll tell you, that is the reward of everything. When somebody says, thank you for helping me get through school, I can live with that.
Ahead on the program, singer, songwriter, author, and shepherdess Eliza Blue joins us from the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls for Moment in Sound. Live music is next on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Science and Technology Reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
I'm guessing when most people hear the name Louis Armstrong, they think of a lovable old guy with a gravelly voice singing Hello, Dolly, and What a Wonderful World. But there was much more to his legacy than that. He was the most important American musical figure of the 20th century. Armstrong was born 120 years ago today, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear a few of his classic recordings. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Turbach Law Office in Watertown. Attorneys handling insurance and personal injury claims, willing to work hard for injured people and their families. Learn more about the attorneys at turbachlaw.com.
Walk out the door and your world changes. Dark to light, quiet to noise. The stars, the sounds of insects and birds, kids playing, waves crashing, cars passing. Even in our most peaceful moments, the world is always moving, changing. Something big is happening somewhere. Take NPR with you and stay connected to the world outside your door. Listen live on your phone, at this station's website, or npr.org.
Listen at sdpb.org or download our app.
Program funding provided by photographer Paul Horsted and his book, The Black Hills, Yesterday and Today. More than 100 then and now photographs revealing historic places from Custer to Deadwood and Mount Rushmore to the Badlands. More at paulhorsted.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Eliza Blue is in eastern South Dakota working on new episodes of her traveling concert television show, Wish You Were Here. The new season premieres Thursday, September 2nd. It's at 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain on SDPB TV1 After Dakota Life. And Eliza has been kind enough to stop by the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to say hello and to play some music for us. Hey, welcome.
It is great to be here.
We don't normally see you outside of the ranch.
Yeah, it's true. I know. Yeah, we crossed the river. I was traveling with my kids, and we crossed the river, and I was like, oh, my gosh, we haven't done this in a while.
Yeah. Perkins County, we talked to you recently about the drought and the impact on ranchers. The last year has been really tough on musicians. It has also brought some creativity from artists, including the show Wish You Were Here, where you said, let's take this show on the road. Before we talk about the show a little bit and how it got started in your mind, let's hear some music first, because this song ties into that question of where this program came from.
Well, so this very first song is the opening credits of Wish You Were Here features a snippet of it. But it's funny because I was working last summer. I was doing some songwriting, and obviously, you know, many of us were kind of homebound, or in my case, ranch bound. And so I wrote this traveling song, and it was so funny to, you know, to not be able to travel, and just that wanderlust was welling up. So that was kind of the inspiration for the song, and then eventually the inspiration for the show. So
first day summer, valleys are blooming, I'm going roaming, leave me as you found me, take my hand. Wake up in the morning, don't know where I'm going, think I'll take the highway. If you're going my way, take my hand. Take my hand. Take my hand. I'm Dakota bound. Lay down in the evening, lit up by the starshine. If I can't find my way back home, at least I've got the open road, take my hand. Back roads and byways, campfires will lie awake, sweet grass and summer sage, blowing sway and honey, take my hand. Take my hand, take my hand. We're Dakota bound. Take my hand. I've been here before, in this wild flowered field. I have opened the door to the world, to the wheel. And I know when I'm found, I'll find my feet at touching sacred ground. Take my hand. Take my hand, we're Dakota bound.
gosh, it's nice to have you back in this studio. Yay. Oh. That's for you just tuning in. Moment in Sound with Eliza Blue. She's East River, working on the next season of Wish You Were Here, which is a travelogue of music on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. You can watch the previous episodes on the SDPB watch page now at sdpb.org/watch. And the new season starts in September. So give us a little preview of the East River journey.
Well, we have really expanded the focus for this new season, and I'm so excited because we filmed the first four episodes. It was during the pandemic, and the inspiration was kind of, you know, people aren't able to go see live music. You know, we as musicians are not able to play concerts, so we kind of wanted to recreate a live music experience, but with no other people. So then for this new season, it was kind of like, okay, well, now we want to go kind of the exact opposite direction. We want to bring as many people in as we can. So each of the episodes, we're going all over South and North Dakota. And we've got other musicians we're featuring. We've got some visual artists we're featuring. Mm-hmm. We've got poets. So in addition to getting to see cool places across our state and places that, you know, might be a little off the beaten path, we kind of tried to find the hidden gems. We also are going to be bringing in other people who will help us tell the story of that place.
Nice.
So, I just couldn't be more excited. And I have to say, I feel, you know, just selfishly, like it's been such a fun adventure getting to see these people and hang out with them. So I think it's going to be great for audiences as well.
It is a story of place. The show, you know, you think of it as the music, but it's also the story of place. Who are some of the people that you're working with for this upcoming season? What can you tell us about some of your collaborators?
Well, so for the premiere episode that will happen in September, that's actually the one we were filming this week. And so we went to Blackshire Farms, which is the farm of Marcella Prokup and her husband, Sean McFarland. Marcella is a poet. Her husband is a songwriter who's in a lot of Sioux Falls bands, including Snakebeard Jackson. I think they're performing this weekend at the Sioux River Folk Fest. But anyway, so he shares some songs with us, she shares some poems, and then they also give us a tour of their farm where they have started an heirloom apple cider orchard, which is unique in our region. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Marcella was like the person who taught one of the first writing workshops I ever took in South Dakota.
That's so cool.
You know, post college, you know, like she was at the library. Absolutely adore her and her work. Have not met her husband, so it'll be great. What else will you play for us today here?
Well, I was going to do a song that I actually performed in one of the episodes from last season, and this was probably my favorite episode. We got to go to the Holy Spirit Chapel, sometimes it's called the Stone Church, which I had heard about and seen photographs of, but had never been to because it's on the Standing Rock Reservation, but it's also so hard to get to that the road you take to get there is really just like two pickup trails through a pasture. So even just finding it is a little tricky, but it's beautiful. It was built by parishioners out of stones quarried from the cliff in the nearby Firesteel Creek. It's just a powerful place spiritually. And it was amazing to be there and to share songs from there. And this was a song that I actually wrote in preparation to go there. So it's called the Stone Church Song.
Speak to me. Of history, a whispering, a reckoning. Cut and can't say how the story ends, but I'm listening and I'm trying to hear when the spirit speaks. Whispers in my ear.
Eliza Blue playing for us live in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. The new season of Eliza Blue's traveling concert television show, Wish You Were Here, premieres Thursday, September 2nd. It's 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain on SDPB TV 1. Previous episodes available online on the SDPB Watch page, sdpb.org/watch. Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure.
I'm going to close the show. You can noodle on the way out if you want to. It's better than theme music. On the next In the Moment, Ibram X. Kendi is a National Book Award-winning author and a leading anti-racism scholar. He's going to join us to respond to Governor Kristi Noem's executive order and tell us a little bit about his work. That's on tomorrow's In the Moment. If you want to look inside the SDPB studio, especially today, you can go to our YouTube page. We're going to post this Eliza Blue moment in sound so you can see her sing and enjoy that music again. Always, you can go online to our show notes at sdpb.org/news. For Chris Loffrey, Steve Zwemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.